Friday, 2nd August, 1974. The deep teachings of the scriptures of the world, in olden days particularly, were esoteric teachings. This does not mean that they were deliberately kept away from people. It does mean they were not given out indiscriminately to anyone and everyone. There are several good reasons for this. The vast majority of human beings never have been and still are not concerned with religion in depth. They are interested in religion. They give their allegiance to a particular religion somewhat superficially, provided they follow out certain rules, carry out certain commandments, etc., about the living of the good life. They are content with that. Rituals and ceremonies interest them, and, of course, have some considerable effect upon them through the subconscious, because symbols have an influence which is more far-reaching than we are prepared to accede to them. So as long as that sort of external form of religion was observed, people were satisfied. It did them a certain amount of good, but they couldn't possibly enter into the deep teachings. It's the same today. Today there are numbers of people who say they would like to know what the truth about it is. And they expect this truth to be told them, either by the spoken word or the written word. And they are under the delusion that because they know the language, that they have had a certain education, the ordinary sort of education we receive in the world, and because they are interested, therefore they will know the truth. Now, hardly anything could be further from the truth than that approach. It is sheer presumption on my part, as an ordinary man of the world, to imagine that just because I have been to school, just because I have read this, that and the other, and have this, that and the other skill in the ordinary way, I am capable of understanding the reality which is presented as truth in terms of thought and speech. The deep things of life need something more than this intellectual capacity we have to see, to understand. We see and we understand in terms of the functioning of our sense perceptions, our daily percepts, our concepts, our conditioned mind, and the way in which the brain is taught to work by others. This is as far as intellect goes. And we think that because we have this, we will understand the deep truths of religion. But the deep truths of all the world's great religions go far deeper than the intellect can penetrate. Man has tried to put in terms of speech and conceptual, logical thinking that which transcends such thinking. In actual fact, this means that there are faculties in the mind which are dormant in all of us. If and when those faculties open up, we are awake, as we might say, enlightened, purified, etc., etc. When those faculties awaken, we are aware of existence, of reality, in quite different terms from the manner in which we are aware through our training, our conditioning, in terms of intellectual presentations, which are restricted to sense, speech, and discursive thought functioning. Let us look at one or two details in this connection. How are we conscious of the world in which we live? We are conscious in terms of separate particulars where objects and persons are concerned. We are conscious of our own self isolatively. That is to say, we are conscious of ourselves as I who am separate and different from you and the rest of the world. We are conscious, in other words, in terms of the self, not self duality. Which one of us, for example, is conscious in terms of totality? In terms of us, let us confine ourselves just for, in order to really to get hold of this, let us confine ourselves to those of us who are present here now. Are we conscious at this moment of all present here as a single, whole us? Or are we conscious of I and Ruth and Andrew and Murray and Joan and so on? How are we conscious? We are conscious only in terms of separateness, aren't we? Our self-consciousness is rigidly isolative. We cannot go break through this barrier. Now, we can imagine what it might be if we were to break through this barrier. But our imagination will everlastingly fall short of the reality, and even if to some degree or other, it does represent the reality, it will be such a shadow of the reality. It is somewhat comparable to our state before we were born within the mother's body, and our state after we are born, and not immediately afterwards, but when our senses have begun to work and function and we gradually become aware of the world. What a totally different world it is. We in this world can imagine, and scientific research has revealed a good few things, we can imagine what it probably was like when we were within the mother's body. But within the mother's body, it's totally impossible to imagine what it is like for all those thousands, millions of adults outside the mother's body. Now, it is like that. This us consciousness, this unitary whole consciousness, is something which utterly transcends our ordinary separative consciousness. Now, in the state of whole unitary consciousness, how are we aware of existence? What sort of perceptions, if one may use such a word in that context, what sort of feelings, what sort of rapport with reality is there in that state? We don't know. And we can't talk about it either. If I were within the mother's body, and let us assume that I can perhaps, well, we will say that there were twins. Can I tell the other chap inside the mother's body what it is like outside? I can't. I have no means of doing it. And yet there are some links. There are just a few words in the language, like infinity, or God, or transcendence, or perfection, or use what word you like. There are some words like that which negate our shortcomings, our imperfections. Finitude, particularity, is negated by a word like infinite, totality, or the whole. Is it not? Now, if certain conditions hold good, this power to negate that which is our ordinary experience could, up to a point, put us in touch with that inner reality, even within the very limited sphere of thought and speech. We can produce some sort of conceptions which will necessarily not be clear-cut, therefore. They will be poetic expressions. They will be suggestive expressions which indicate that there is this other. Now, it was precisely this other, this transcendent other, which was realized, and in our own day and age is realized, by a few people in the world who lived the religious life in depth. And they try to use this very fallible, this very poor medium of logically structured concept and words in order to express this which is inwardly realized. Now, when I say inwardly realized, do remember, it's right beyond any sort of emotion, any sort of feeling that we know down here, any and certainly any and every sort of logical thinking process. It's right and way beyond that. Now, the deep scriptures, the deep teachings of the scriptures of the world have used words, of course, because there is nothing else to use unless you use pictures. That also has been used, you see, to suggest this inward reality. The deep script, the deep teachings have been put in the scriptures in words then. Now it is our business, when we read those scriptures, to remember this first and foremost, our limitations. Next, it becomes important. It becomes imperative that we should live that kind of life by which we can transcend, free ourselves from the limitations of sense discursive mind activity. Then we become aware in this new way, this other way. What happens with religious discipline in the deep sense and with religious fruition in the supreme sense is that there is a total transformation, a transmutation in fact, of mind and consciousness. That is what happens. And it happens and can happen only whilst you are alive here. When the body is dead, that is the end of all that comes under our terms, mind and consciousness. Consciousness, mind, body, they are all a single complex, a single unity. If any one of those elements is clean out, the whole thing is out. Consider, have you ever seen a living creature, not merely a man, but any ordinary animal, which was totally devoid of mind? In fact, science knows enough to suggest that a single living cell shows evidence of the presence of mind. The fact that it can learn, and the fact that even the very simple organisms, right from the plant kingdom, can show the power of delaying a response indicates choice. Well, what is it that chooses but the mind? So now, you've never come across a living organism which is totally mindless. Nor have you ever come across a mind by itself which was bodiless. Isn't that so? Look into this very deeply. Now, the body comes to maturity easily enough through the hundreds of millions of years on this planet since living organisms came into being, organisms, not just single cells, since living organisms came into being, the whole process of nature, the life trend, has worked in such a way that the body, whether it be a tree or a mollusk or a fish or a human body, whatever it is, it comes to maturity simply by virtue of being born and growing. And it is all a natural process, as we call it. That is to say, not thought out, not decided by the creature or the plant from the moment of its birth. It doesn't say, now I'm going to grow like this and become that. You can't do it. This is nature, as we call it. But this nature holds within itself mind. It is not separate from mind. Mind and matter are two words to express a half mode of awareness of the one total reality, of the one whole reality. But whilst nature brings the body, the material body, to maturity, only a certain degree of maturity of mind is possible through natural processes. Now, why is this? How is it that this is so? Consider the difference between ourselves, human beings, and animals. Certainly the vast bulk of animals. What is the difference? The fundamental difference. The animal cannot look within himself and know himself as himself separate from the other animal. He is conscious in terms of another animal. Look into this, try and see into it very deeply. The way in which you or I am a self-conscious person, very conscious of self and all my internal processes. I can contemplate my past through my memory, I can contemplate my death, which will come inevitably. And of course I can have fantasies about the period between now and death. Imagination, anticipation, I can have all that. Can any animal do that? It doesn't. So now, this is a faculty which we have. And in addition to this faculty, there are lots of, this we actually have at present, there are lots of other dormant faculties held within the living organism. Now be very careful, I'm saying living organism, which is a body-mind-consciousness organism. But when I have said body-mind-consciousness, I could add a few more words, but that just exhausts my present knowledge of the living organism. It doesn't exhaust all the possibilities that may lie within this organism, of which I am totally ignorant. Now, this one of the great possibilities which has come to fruition in individual cases during the last 6, 7, 8 thousand years or whatever it be, is this transformation of the mode of awareness of existence. You and I are aware in terms of separateness, of particularity, of finitude. we are not aware in terms of totality. Now, it was that kind of awareness which came into being through the religious life. And those people tried to convey this. And you see the difficulty of conveying. All our conceptual thinking, all our speech is entirely restricted, confined within the sphere of limitation, of finitude, of measurability, comparison, making and breaking relationships, and so forth. In terms of totality, all these disappear, don't they? Now the intellect can at least see that logically, although consciousness cannot be aware of it as a natural reality. You see the point? Now, the Kabbalah and the Veda, the deep teachings of the Bible and the Old and the New Testaments, the Vedas and the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, the Upanishads, the teachings of the Buddha, of Zarathustra, Lao Tzu, all the great teachers, their inner depth is concerned with this state, this transformed, transcendent state. If I have not eyes, it's perfectly obvious I cannot see. If I have not released within my living being these profounder faculties, I cannot know what they alone can reveal, or rather what I can be conscious of as a matter of course and a matter of fact through the use of those developed faculties. And that's all there is to it. So you see why the world of scholarship, the world of pure intellectualist philosophy, falls badly, and it falls without knowing that it has fallen badly, when it tries to write tomes and tomes about the deeps of religion. The externals, yes. That's all kindergarten stuff. Child's play. And unfortunately, it doesn't just stop short at child's play, because on account of misinterpretation, mankind is misled. Immense harm comes, immense sorrow comes. Look at all the crusades and the wars and the cruelties and the oppressions in the name of the transcendent. In the name of the wholeness, the holiness, the worst crimes of man have been perpetrated. See? You know how often I say, keep away from religion unless you mean business. Now you'll ask me, well, what is business in this context? Quite simple, quite simple. Purification of the mind and the heart. Constant mindfulness throughout the day. And if you like, the specific meditation, when you have the opportunity and the inclination, which consists of the two main aspects, discursive meditation and pure meditation. As you all know, discursive meditation is the usual sort of thing that one enters into. It is a verbal ritual. It is also a ritual of not only of speech, but of thought and feeling, which you can control insofar as you hold it to a fixed point. The devotee, for example, who, all conditions being favorable, is able to pour out his whole being in adoration to the Supreme or whatever it is, he can hold it like that. It's just one act, one action, isn't it? A single action, uninterrupted. But there comes the point when it stops. And then the thought-speech process starts up again, and he proceeds to the next thing, and so on till it comes to the end, whatever the end may be. In a church ritual, in a congregational process, or, for example, when we have the sort of, you know, conducted meditation in a group and so forth, it is like a church service. It just starts at the beginning and goes on. When you are by yourself, you can, all conditions being favorable, you can stay put at one point for a minute, an hour, 2 hours, according to your capacity. That's the discursive meditation, remember. That doesn't take you into transcendence. When the discursive process stops and you are wholly awake, then you are in the state of pure meditation. Because there are no words there. You are not thinking. You are not proceeding from point to point. Do you remember? There is no thing, whether material or imaginary, intellectual, mental, there is no thing there. Then you are in the state of pure meditation. This is the state of pure communion. Why? Because when there is no thing present, no limitation, no finitude, no particularity, there are no relationships between different particulars of which you are separatively conscious. This is the point. Separative consciousness has completely disappeared. It has become transformed into the supreme single awareness. The Buddha used that wonderful phrase, Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Consciousness which is without characteristics, which means therefore non-finite, infinite, anidassanam, anantam, endless. If it is endless, it's beginningless. There is no proceeding, there is no measuring, there is no movement as we understand it. But I will use one word. There is vibrating in poise here now with an intensity which is beyond all imagination. You have to experience this to know what it is like. And that is why your mystic very often, and your person who meditates, gets into that terrible state physically. That is one of the reasons why this, in India for instance, I suppose it was originally developed in India to the extent that it has been the physical aspect of yoga, the asanas and the pranayama, they all come in. They prepare the body. You see, it's like having an apparatus which will take the terrific voltage. This bulb will take 240 volts. Give it 1,000,000 volts and see what happens. You see, the body has to be prepared for that million volt impact of the transcendent. So now, having realized that, in that state of awareness, you sort of come down through the grades again. You involve into sense mind terms, into ordinary, everyday, discriminative consciousness, vijnana. Simply vijnana, not vijnanam anidarsanam. This is where the Upanishads, I think, had the advantage. They used another word, atma. Atma means precisely this. You involve back into ordinary everyday consciousness. Now in that ordinary everyday consciousness, and with the functioning of the brain, the intellectual faculties at their finest, they can't break through this barrier. So the deep things of religion, where the deep things are concerned, the attempt has been made to use a few words which might have such an impact upon you that if your heart aspires towards it, you might be able to enter complete purity. And why the purity? What is the necessity for the purity? And this is the thing which you must bear in mind in connection with this unfortunate problem that has arisen. We'll take a trip into the transcendent by means of drugs. The ignorant and the deliberately stupid do it. Why the purity? And then you will see why I pronounce this uncompromising stricture upon drugs. When you enter into communion, when you are constantly mindful in the ordinary everyday life, as you cross the street and get into the bus, and as you cook the meal or as you have your bath, when you are constantly mindful, what is it that interferes with that mindfulness? My own repressed feelings, my hates, my annoyances, my desires above all. I want to do this, I want to become that, I want to get rid of this depression which overpowers me. All these things come about. Now you'll understand one of the difficulties in the path of the extremely sincere, well-meaning religious man. He tries to live the good life and he finds all this coming upon him. Memories will come up. My past failures when I was a youngster. I couldn't get through O-level, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do the other, never got on with my teachers, had an unhappy relationship with my father and mother. My family thinks I'm a failure, they are always criticizing me, they are always against me. Whatever I do is wrong, you see. I'm no good, my brothers and sisters are fine, they've got on in the world. Married wives and have had quivers full of children and great big bank balances and whatnot, and I am like this. So I feel depressed and miserable, and it all comes weighing down upon me like that. You see? But you see, fundamentally, the trouble and the difficulty is myself. It is true that I went through all this miserable failure and pain and all the rest of it, health and whatnot. You see, it's true. But It is I who have not completely resolved all those discords which are held in the well of my subconscious. They are what are called the indelible memories. Now, it is not the fact that they are memories which is the trouble. You don't want to forget. That's a great mistake. Don't try to forget. Oh, no. Let the memory be there, and thank goodness that the memory is there. Because as long as those memories are there, you can call them up and at last fully understand them. If you once fully understand, remember, you have dissolved the power of those demons to interfere with your state of communion, with your mindfulness, with your meditation. This is the real psychotherapy. There is no other. All the rest is fooling about. Whether you use big names like Freud or Broid or whoever he is. This is the real psychotherapy. The soul is transformed, it is made healthy, the mind is brought to full maturity. You are man, which means that the totality, transcendence itself, God Himself, has come to realization through you, the finite being. His infinity, His omniscience, His omnipotence, His absoluteness, His perfection, love, wisdom, beauty, goodness, truth, anything you like. All that has come to fruition through the particular and the limited. You yourself are the divine being embodied. That is the real psychotherapy. So now you see, what is it that interferes with the mindfulness? Not merely the memories of the past, but the way I am oriented toward them. I failed. I want happiness. I want success. Believe me. I can ask you to believe me. These things have no place in terms of the whole truth, in terms of reality. And the whole truth is just the one totality, which is the transcendent reality, a completely whole, organic, spiritual, use any adjective you like, reality, in which there is no absence of relationship. The void is totally full. See? But if you are aware, in order to become aware in that way, you have to slide out of the I am I bondage. The bondage upon us through the consciousness of I am I separate from you. Now you see, to try and tell the deep truths, this sort of, I've just sort of touched, sort of tried to penetrate an inch into the depths. How is this to be conveyed to the ordinary person? It's very difficult. What words, therefore? And words are confined to the limited and the particular there, with the exception of those few words like infinite and absolute and so on. You see? Words deal only with that which belongs to the sphere of mortality. The prince of this world, the lord of death, he is the ruler of this entire sphere, the good things and the bad things alike, the duality, the whole of the duality. the whole of the ambivalent state. The Lord of Death rules it. But when you see into this, not just with the intellect, and I have no option but to try and present it in intellectual terms, otherwise I just have to be silent. You see? When you have really transcended this ambivalence, this duality, then all the particular things are there. All the finite things are there. But you are conscious of all those finite things in terms of a totality in which they are all held in complete relationship. And hence the wholeness. Take your own body, which is such a marvelous teacher if you only know how to learn from the body. When you're well and strong and fit and fine, feeling fine, have you ever noticed that you are whole conscious of your body? But if you have been indulging in several bottles the previous night and the morning after the night before feeling, you're not whole conscious of your body and say, oh my God, I've got such an awful head. But you don't feel that when you're all right, do you? Your body sense, your body feeling, your body consciousness is one whole harmonious reality. Now when the mind has come to maturity, then mind and consciousness are at one with all the particulars that comprise the universe. And it is one whole reality, state of harmony. This is the meaning of divinity, of God, of transcendence. This is the meaning of holiness. Hence, the marvel and the wonder and the beauty. And you know, it is all embodied in every particular and finite thing. Just look at those clouds there, lighted up by the sun. Beautifully lighted up. And if you are just in tune with them, they are not just clouds. They are eternal God in manifestation. So, I hope that the point you raised up, Brett, has been rather a useful point. There are so many things to consider. Consider deeply and carefully. Consider, I repeat, the meaning of that word. Con together with, and the sidar part from sidus, sidar is a star, a self-shining light. Look into the light of truth, and therefore the words must stop. Feel into it, that's all. Be silent here. And whatsoever particular thing is present will speak out the whole truth to you. And you will know it without words, without thoughts. It is a mode of awareness which is totally different. This is what religion is concerned with. And neither science nor philosophy can deal with that, or does deal with it. Philosophies of religion do try to relate the two in terms of a thought-speech structure. But every philosopher, if he is a truly religious man, must be awake to the fact that what he has said is just a nice little sandcastle, and he should be delighted when the next wave comes and it's all gone.